loved one, Omero, and they're still looking for him.
And Lisa, the population of Brooks County is just about 7,000 people, and yet estimates are that as many as 2,000 migrants have presumed dead since 2008. Could you talk about the county itself?
I mean, it's mostly private ranch land. If anyone knows anything about Texas, a lot of Texas, and especially South Texas, is these really vast ranches. One ranch, the King Ranch, is bigger than the state of Rhode Island, so that gives you a sense of how vast these ranches are. And migrants are dropped off south of the checkpoint, so they can circumvent the checkpoint. And they walk on these private ranches for days, and they run out of water. It's very, very hot in South Texas. So that's how they are dying and going missing.
Well, let me go back to Eddie Canales. You are surrounded, our radio listeners can't see, but our TV viewers can see, by people holding pictures, Eddie. Can you each say your name and your loved one who you're looking for?
Diga su nombre.
Mi nombre es Araceli de Mejía y busco a mi hijo Edwin Alexander Colindez Ramírez.
Mi nombre es Karen Carrasco y busco a mi hermano Aarón Eleazar Carrasco Turcios.
¿De dónde es usted?
Yo soy de Honduras y mi hermano tiene 9 años desaparecido.
¿Y usted?
Mi nombre es Ángela Lacayo, soy de Honduras y busco a mi hijo Harvey José Velázquez Lacayo.
Eddie, we thank you.
Mi nombre es Irma Yolanda Pérez, vengo de Guatemala y ando en busca de mi hijo Herbert Estuardo García Pérez, que desapareció hace 11 años, el 10 de noviembre.
Migrants, yes, from Honduras and Guatemala. Eddie, your final thoughts.
Well, again, this is a constant situation with families that are calling us and here at the center in terms of the search. And this delegation of families are here in the United States to bring attention to the situation and try to figure out, you know, what are the obstacles and what's preventing them from being able to find their loved ones that are missing. Have been missing for a long time.
And we will continue to follow these stories. Eddie, thanks so much for being with us. Eddie Canales, South Texas Human Rights Center, and Lisa Malamut, the co-director of Missing in Brooks County. Juan, we have 30 seconds. There's a major multi-day march going on in New Jersey where you are.
Yes, Amy, the People's Organization for Progress, led by Larry Hamm, longtime activist, is walking across the state. They started in Montclair, New Jersey. They're marching all the way to Trenton, over 60 miles throughout the week, to press the issues of police abuse bills that are before the legislature, and the legislature is refusing to act on, including subpoena power for civilian complaint review boards, making chokeholds illegal, and so forth. So it's an important march, and it'll end on Trenton on Saturday.
And we'll catch up with Larry Hamm in these coming days. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Miguel Noguera. Democracy Now! Has 2 job openings. Check at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
This is KBOO Community Radio. We are in our fall drive exploring the sounds of democracy. Here at KBOO, we believe that, much like democracy, community radio is an ever-evolving experiment. And as the needs of our communities grow and change, we remain true to our mission of uplifting underrepresented voices, playing local musicians, and keeping you updated with local news and current events. Show your support by donating right now at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44321 or click donate in the KBOO mobile app.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on this Fall Fun Drive edition of the KABU Evening News, memorial held for murdered Portland activist Sean Kellyer. Michigan tribe urges Biden to honor treaty and close pipeline. And in international news, Bowman in Norway kills five, injures others. Good evening, this is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, October 13, 2021. KABU is currently in our Fall Fun Drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Ethan Sandweiss. Oregon passed 4,000 total COVID deaths this week. 1,000 Oregonians died from COVID in the past 2 months alone. Yesterday was the state's deadliest since the pandemic began, with 82 deaths reported by the Oregon Health Authority. The reported increase can be partially attributed to delays in reporting, but the state's transition rates are still higher than at any point during 2020. The majority of the dead were unvaccinated. In addition to new deaths, 1,413 new cases were reported. With hospitalizations down today, just 8% of adult ICU beds and 7% of adult non-ICU beds are still available in Oregon hospitals. When Donald Trump appointed Louis DeJoy to the position of Postmaster General, the shipping company executive vowed to gut employee benefits, boost costs, eliminate capacity, and slow delivery speeds for the U.S. Postal Service. With the holidays around the corner, Oregon postal workers fear they will be unable to accommodate the yearly demand for first-class shipping. Emily Scott has more on the story.
Ahead of the busiest season of the year for the U.S. Postal Service, some Oregon postal workers are voicing concerns about the latest policy changes. They include new service standards that slow down first-class mail delivery. Mail traveling less than 1,000 miles should reach its destination in 3 days, and mail traveling more than 1,900 miles will take about 5 days. The Postal Service has also hiked rates for mail, packages, and other special services. Joe Kogan of Portland's local postal workers union says with these changes and staffing issues, he doesn't think the Postal Service is prepared for the holiday crunch.
I just don't know how any organization or business can survive if you're reducing service and charging more. It just doesn't make sense to me. I can tell you that the employees that I represent, you know, we want to serve our customers to the best of our ability, and we believe that this action prevents us from doing that.
Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has said the Postal Service is hiring 40,000 seasonal workers to help with the holiday rush, and that the changes are needed to trim a $160 billion loss by 2030. Christopher Shaw is an author and historian of the U.S. Postal Service and says he's already hearing reports of how these changes are affecting small business owners. They often depend on first-class mail and have said the slowdown will impact their day-to-day operations. Shaw thinks some may turn to other delivery providers, which could lead to further privatization of the industry.
These changes are part of a trend where the Postal Service is conceived of not as a public service, and instead more like a for-profit business, which could very well lead to a degradation of the service that Americans have expected and received over the years.
The changes are part of DeJoy's 10-year plan called Delivering for America, which includes modernizing the vehicle fleet and making investments in mail processing facilities. I'm Emily Scott with Oregon News Service.
Oregon State Senator Casey Jama and Representative Khan Pham are working to prepare the state for the resettlement of around 180 Afghan refugees. The work group Jama and Pham created is tackling issues pertinent to every area of refugee life, from housing to legal aid and language service. Casey Jama remarked that efforts were needed to rebuild Oregon's resettlement programs that were gutted under the nativist Trump administration. Considering already sparse state benefits and a fierce housing market, integrating refugees is expected to be a challenge, but supporters of the program are optimistic. Matthew Westerbeck, Director of Refugee Services for the Catholic Charities of Oregon, says, quote, "We're well poised because we have strong leadership in the state legislature, strong champion and leadership in the governor's office to ensure that Oregon is very welcoming. We'll see that come into shape in the coming weeks and months around exactly what the state's investment is going to be." Jama and Pham hope the groundwork they lay now will prepare Oregon for refugee resettlement in the future. A memorial was held downtown last night for murdered 23-year-old activist Sean Kellyer. Kellyer was intentionally hit and killed by unknown assailants in an SUV 2 years ago yesterday. The attack occurred outside Cider Riot, a now-closed pub that was popular among left-wing activists. After an argument between Kellyer's friends and an unidentified group, members from the other group entered a vehicle and slammed Kellyer into the building. Kellyer's friend Hyatt Eshelman fired at the vehicle with a legally concealed handgun, and its owners fled. Kellyer died from blunt force trauma in a nearby hospital. Details surrounding Kellyer's murder remain a mystery, although they had access to the perpetrator's registered vehicle, witnesses, and security camera footage, the Portland Police Bureau never made arrests or named persons of interest. Kellyer's mother believes the police neglected to investigate her son's murder because of his previous clashes with law enforcement. The incident marked a stark contrast with the public execution of anti-fascist Michael Reinl by the police last September. Reinl shot and killed far-right demonstrator Aaron Danielson that August. On September 17th in Olympia, Washington, federal law enforcement shot Reinl 37 times without announcing their presence or attempting arrest. Last night's memorial for Sean Kellyer took place outside the Justice Center downtown. Mourners lit fireworks in solidarity. A different sort of mass shooting occurred today in Konigsberg, Norway, where a lone man shot and killed multiple people with a bow and arrows. The attack occurred at 6:30 in the evening local time, or 9:30 a.m. Pacific. Norwegian police were given rare authorization to carry firearms to apprehend the shooter. Police announced at 12:34 p.m. Pacific time that they had apprehended the suspect. The incident marks Norway's deadliest mass casualty attack since 2011, when ultranationalist terrorist Anders Breivik killed 69 people, bombing a tower block and shooting children at a summer camp for the Workers' Youth League. The shooter's identity and motivations are not yet public. A recent survey by the Center for Community Solutions found that a majority of Ohio households reported experiencing food insecurity during the pandemic, and 78% were struggling to pay living expenses. Government assistance programs have largely kept working families afloat, and some residents there hope Biden's Build Back Better plan could make it possible to continue addressing their needs. Here's Mary Sherman with Ohio News Connection.
A new survey of Ohioans confirms assistance programs have been a lifeline for families reeling from the effects of the pandemic. The findings from the Center for Community Solutions show nearly all forms of public assistance and benefits saw increased use during the pandemic, with 48% of Ohio households reporting a loss of employment income and 78% struggling to afford living expenses. Lead study author Alex Dorman adds most of the people surveyed said they also experienced food insecurity.
What absolutely shocked me was the high number of lower and middle income households in Ohio that not only were worrying about running out of food, but at one point did experience running out of food during the pandemic and weren't able to overcome that.
In the survey, 40% of households said they've turned to food banks in the pandemic, compared to about 20% who did so before. There was also a 12% increase in the use of unemployment insurance and a 7% increase in people who receive SNAP benefits. Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, Lisa Hamler-Fugit, says it's clear that pandemic assistance programs improve the lives of those hit the hardest. The concern now, she notes, is what happens when temporary assistance ends.
We have learned very valuable lessons during this crisis, and we need to make sure that we understand that there is an interdependency between the health and safety and the overall well-being of our hungry friends and neighbors.
Hamler-Fugit also sees a new awareness of the role that food pantries and charities play in responding to the needs of the community.
It's a combination of both public and private, but we need to make sure that we've got a strong safety net and support basic needs like food, personal care, and the capacity of food banks and food pantries to effectively and efficiently be able to serve their communities at large.
She contends that means passing public policies like the Build Back Better plan in Congress. She believes it would strengthen communities through investments like the refundable child tax credits that's helped many Ohio families meet basic needs. This is Mary Sherman for Ohio News Connection.
The Social Security Administration announced its largest one-year cost of living adjustment, giving its recipients an additional 5.9%. Still, that amount falls well short of increased living costs. Whereas annual adjustments have increased payments by 55% in the past 20 years, seniors' expenses have more than doubled. Inflation and shortages caused by the COVID pandemic are making the problem worse. 40% of Social Security recipients depend on monthly checks for at least 90% of their income. Two-thirds require them for at least half. According to the Senior Citizens League, hundreds of retired and disabled elders emailed them last month unable to pay their bills. The U.S. Supreme Court began debate on a Kentucky anti-choice law yesterday over the question of whether a state attorney general could defend the law struck down by two courts and the state's governor. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The issue before the Supreme Court is very specifically about that procedural question: should the Attorney General have been allowed to intervene at such a late stage after the courts had already struck down the law twice, or did the Sixth Circuit get it right and he shouldn't have been allowed to intervene?
Attorney Heather Getnarek with the ACLU of Kentucky explains oral arguments the Supreme Court heard yesterday involving a 2018 Kentucky abortion law that bans a medical abortion method used after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The issue before the court involves the role of the state's Republican Attorney General, Daniel Cameron. The House on Tuesday cleared legislation to raise the debt limit into early December, ensuring that the nation doesn't default on its debts next week. The temporary measure will only offer lawmakers a brief reprieve from the partisan impasse. Another stopgap measure to fund the government also expires on December 3rd. Former President Barack Obama will campaign with Virginia Democratic gubernatorial candidate Terry McAuliffe, who is in a tight race with Republican Glenn Youngkin. Obama will join McAuliffe on October 23rd in Richmond. Americans' trust in President Biden has eroded as they've slowed their expectations for how quickly they can get back to their pre-pandemic lives, according to a new Axios Ipsos poll. The survey specifically measured Americans' trust in Biden to provide them with accurate information on COVID-19. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
We don't get too glum around here. Even if things look challenging, our view and his view is that he was elected to continue to press forward and address the challenges the American people are facing.
The California Department of Justice has opened an investigation into the oil spill that occurred off Huntington Beach this month. California Attorney General Rob Bonta said authorities from his office will work to determine the cause of the spill and what could have been done to prevent it. U.S. Coast Guard Officer Steve Stromer talked about restoring birds that were damaged from the oil spill.
They have their own room. They have especially quiet in there. So we're trying to get them healthy and back out on the beach as soon as we can.
ICE agents will no longer conduct mass raids on workplaces where undocumented immigrants are employed, according to a new order by Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Finally, more than 135 people were arrested outside the White House protesting a climate emergency and calling for the end to fossil fuel projects. More climate protests are planned in Washington throughout the week as part of a mobilization dubbed People vs. Fossil Fuels. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, Lessons Learned from California Wildfire Recovery. Then at 7, it's Sojourner Truth. Tonight's weather is in the high 40s and rainy. Rain will continue tomorrow with temperatures in the 50s. Today in 1983, America's first cellular network was launched in Chicago by Ameritech Mobile Communications. The quote of the day is from Todd Chavez. I'm starting to think smartphones are actually making us less connected. Texas-based airlines, Southwest and American Airlines, are defying an executive order from Republican Governor Greg Abbott by requiring their workers to get vaccinated. Contractors of the federal government are required to be vaccinated by federal law, but Abbott's order fines employers up to $1,000 for a vaccine mandate. Gary Kelly, the CEO of Southwest Airlines, said that while he did not personally approve of the mask mandate, his company would comply with federal orders. American Airlines struck a neutral tone, saying, quote, "We are reviewing the executive order issued by Governor Abbott, but we believe that federal vaccine mandate supersedes any conflicting state laws." When asked why Abbott would outlaw vaccine mandates, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki answered with one word, politics. 68,000 Texans have died from COVID-19, more than any state except California. The White House is finally reopening America's land borders to fully vaccinated travelers. The new policy will go into effect in November. For over a year and a half, only travelers deemed essential were permitted to drive into the states. The Department of Homeland Security and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are reportedly still working through the process of validating vaccine documentation. Additionally, the order stipulates that as of January 2022, even essential workers will have to show proof of complete vaccination before crossing the border. Also in November, international air travelers will be required to show proof of vaccination before entering the country. That means vaccinated people from countries under U.S. travel bans, including China, Iran, the UK, Brazil, and India, will now be permitted to enter the country. The major exception to the rule is U.S. citizens and permanent residents, who will be permitted to return regardless of vaccination status. Canada recently also opened its borders to vaccinated Americans, whereas Mexico has never requested testing or proof of vaccination to enter the country. The Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation is working to get New Yorkers of color into biking as a means of combating climate change. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. CityBike, New York City's bike share program, launched in 2013. For the first couple of years, the bikes and docking stations were placed only in Lower Manhattan and a small area of Brooklyn. That sent a signal.
That this resource was primarily here for, you know, white young professionals commuting to their Wall Street jobs.
That's Alexis Harrison of the Bedford-Stuyvesant Restoration Corporation. It's a nonprofit in Bed-Stuy, an historically black Brooklyn neighborhood. She says when CityBike later expanded into Bed-Stuy, many longtime residents were not supportive because they felt the program was not for them. But biking is good for people's health, reduces pollution, and is affordable. So Harrison's group worked to get more people of color on bikes. They organized block parties and community bike rides in Bed-Stuy to get people involved.
Our deep engagement work really did help increase CityBike participation.
And they helped establish a citywide discount for people who receive federal food benefits. But she says there's still work to be done to build a biking culture that's open and available for all. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
An oil spill in California last week caused irreversible damage to area wildlife. Now, Michigan's Bay Mills Indian community is urging Biden and Governor Gretchen Whitmer to shut down an illegal pipeline that has already poured over 1 million gallons of oil into the fresh water of the Great Lakes. With more, here's Lily Bolke.
Environmental groups and tribal communities are asking the Biden administration to stand with Governor Gretchen Whitmer in her call to shut down the Line 5 dual pipelines, which run under the Straits of Mackinac. Canada recently invoked a 1977 treaty to get the U.S. to allow Enbridge Energy to continue using the pipelines and says shutting them down would disrupt Canada's natural gas supply. But the National Wildlife Federation's Beth Wallace points out that Line 5 has spilled more than 1 million gallons of oil into the Straits of Mackinac during its nearly 70-year history.
They are ignoring the pipeline has dozens of locations where protective coating has failed. The pipeline is bent in at least 2 locations. It continues to be hit by boat anchors undetected.
On Tuesday, groups delivered a petition with more than 33,000 signatures to Michigan U.S. Senator Gary Peters' office, hoping he'll pass it along to the White House. The petition notes that Indigenous treaty rights precede the 1977 treaty between the U.S. and Canada. Whitney Gravel, president of Bay Mills Indian Community, says in 1836, when tribal nations ceded the lands that became the state of Michigan, they were promised the right to fish, hunt, and gather.
And those treaties include solemn promises that the Anishinaabe, my people, would be able to continue to use the water, the land within that ceded territory to sustain our way of life.
She adds the 1836 treaty rights are still in place today and will remain so as future generations continue to exercise them. Line 5 detractors cite a recent oil spill off the California coast where an underwater pipeline rupture went undetected until tens of thousands of gallons had already entered the ocean. Sean McBeardy with the Oil and Water Don't Mix Coalition says if a similar leak occurred with Line 5, it could be orders of magnitude worse.
This pipeline was much newer than Line 5, built in an era when pipeline technology was better than it was in 1953, and yet the operators in California were not able to shut the line down immediately.
This is Lily Bolke with Michigan News Connection.
The National Congress of American Indians is meeting in D.C. for their annual convention. Vice President Kamala Harris and Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland spoke at the event on issues from federal aid to missing and killed Indigenous women. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Vice President Harris addressed the National Congress of American Indians annual convention Tuesday, which is being held virtually. Harris announced the administration will renegotiate the Department of Interior 477 MOU with tribes. The program allows tribes to combine federal grants for employment and training into a single plan, budget, and reporting system. 12 agencies entered into the MOU. Tribal leaders say they were notified the agencies executed the memorandum without tribal input.
And I don't need to tell you, this program gives tribes the power to make decisions about how best to integrate and deliver federal services within your nations. I know that this is an action that many of you have asked for, and I am optimistic that together we will be able to renegotiate this agreement to support tribal sovereignty.
Harris also touched on a number of tribal issues from missing and murdered Indigenous people, Native vote, to environmental protection. She says the administration is investing in Indian country, pushing for passage of a major infrastructure bill and in their COVID-19 recovery plan. Her remarks were about 8 minutes long.
For too long, Indian issues were relegated only to the Indian Affairs Bureaus. If we're going to make sure that tribal communities thrive, that tribal sovereignty is respected and strengthened, and if we are to truly repair our nation-to-nation relationships, then that means every bureau and every office should be thinking about our country's trust obligations.
Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland addressed the convention after a string of federal officials, laying out her agency's work and commitment to tribes, adding all federal departments should have the same commitment. Haaland highlighted protecting bears' ears and work on her boarding school initiative. Members of the Navajo Nation and the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe recently protested against the only running uranium mill in the United States. From KSJD in Cortez, Colorado, Sophia Stewart Rossi reports.
The White Mesa Uranium Mill sits just a few miles north from White Mesa, Utah, a community that is part of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe. Yolanda Badback, a tribal member, says her and her family have had to adjust their lives to protect themselves from possible contamination caused by the only running uranium mill in the United States.
And so our community members here, they don't drink the water. We go out and they purchase water to drink.
Badback led the annual five-mile march through the desert on Saturday to the White Mesa Mill, which is operated by a Canadian company named Energy Fuels Incorporated. Curtis Moore, Vice President of Marketing and Corporate Development at Energy Fuels, says the 1970s-built mill is operating in accordance with Utah's environmental quality standards.
I can assure them that we're not polluting the groundwater, we're not polluting the air. We're very proud of our track record.
But Scott Klo, Ute Mountain Ute's Environmental Programs Director, says White Mesa Mill had an accident in 2012 that created a discolored cloud. When Klo asked for a follow-up report, it was never given, and he says the incident makes him wonder about accidents that aren't immediately visible.
So, oh great, you want to process rare earths? Tell us about that. How are you going to do that safely?
Company officials and representatives say Energy Fuels does not release information on how White Mesa Mill regulates its uranium and new rare earth minerals and refers to the state of Utah's environmental quality website for guidance. In White Mesa, Utah, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 13th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer tonight is me, Ethan Sandwise, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Romlagon, Anthony Lizowitz, Antonia Gonzalez, Emily Scott, Mary Sherman, and Lily Bolke. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ethan Sandwes. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is in our Fall Fun Drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you would like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact, Lessons Learned from California Wildfire Recovery.